I think that given the circumstances, the best way I can help now is if I step aside and let government get back to governing.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you just heard the voice of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announcing his resignation on Tuesday. Cuomo's decision to step down came in the wake of Attorney General Letitia James's report detailing allegations made by 11 women who say that Cuomo sexually harassed them and created a toxic work environment. But even as he resigned, Andrew Cuomo continued touting his legacy as governor, denying most of the allegations made by the women, and insisting that his decision to leave office was made for the benefit of all New Yorkers. In 13 days, New York State's Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul will take over for Cuomo, making her the first woman to serve as governor in the state's history. Joining me now to discuss these developments are Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine, and Christina Greer, associate professor of political science at Fordham University. She's also co-host of the podcast FAQ NYC. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
All right, Rebecca, I want to start with you because I immediately wanted to talk to you, in part because you and I have been in an ongoing conversation. And of course, you wrote the lovely book around women and anger. And so I'm wondering, when you see what is going on in this moment and Cuomo's decision to resign, if that feels to you like part of a longer trajectory or something that is kind of a standalone moment?
Well, it certainly feels like part of a longer trajectory, but I would emphasize the long trajectory when it comes to a story like this, right? Because, I mean, in the scope of Andrew Cuomo's career as governor, right, he has had two women run against him, making many of the points about his failures beyond sexual harassment, which is ostensibly the reason that he's stepping down right now, right? About his failures of governance. Women have been making that point over the years that he has been in power, to no avail, right? The most recent iteration of the Me Too movement, which exploded in November of 2017 in the wake of the reporting on Harvey Weinstein, preceded Andrew Cuomo behaving in the ways that he behaved with women. It didn't make any impression on him, apparently. If you read Letitia James's report, you will find that more than half of the women she spoke to describe sexualized harassment that happened after the reporting on Harvey Weinstein. So it's not a story like, oh, there was Me Too and women started talking about sexual harassment and then this governor was brought down. Many of these stories that are in Tish James's report were made public in great corroborated detail in the spring of this year, and he has stayed the governor until August. So I want to emphasize that it's not as simple as people, including many women, got furious at Andrew Cuomo and brought him down, because it sure didn't happen that easily or that swiftly, nor was there quite cause effect in that way. This has been a long process, and he sure didn't want it to happen and kicked and screamed and had his own women out there defending him right till the end.
Indeed. And in fact, was still defending himself, Chrissy. And I wonder what you make of his resignation remarks.
The most serious allegations made against me had no credible factual basis in the report. And there is a difference between alleged improper conduct and concluding sexual harassment.
And if you hear in that a willingness to still be maybe thinking at this point about running for political office.
Right. I mean, you listen to that resignation speech, and I think what angered me so was he's still blaming other people. He's still talking about what has been done to him, and he's the victim. And, you know, my biggest pet peeve, Melissa, is if you're going to apologize, you need to apologize wholeheartedly and fall fully on the sword. And he hasn't. He still does not see how he has created not just a culture within his administration, but a culture in Albany that has aided and abetted this type of behavior, not just from him, but by several others as well. So I always say that Andrew Cuomo has been raised in captivity. He knows Albany. He's synonymous with Albany. He's been there since he was 19 years old, living in the shadow of his father, trying to avenge, you know, the fact that his father didn't win his fourth term. I mean, it is a Greek tragedy through and through. but he still fails to recognize the ways in which he has brought himself to this point. And I think that is the piece that will continue to haunt him. And until he can sit back and see the entire history of his behavior, he's not going to be able to move forward. But I don't see that happening with Andrew Cuomo. I will say this. We have a very short political memory. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, especially in New York, you know, we've seen Spitzer have a second act. Schneiderman, I'm sure, could have a second act. We've seen lots of people who have had bad behavior come back, be forgiven. And in many ways, because Andrew Cuomo was America's governor for a period of time, I think that there's still a window for quite a few people who don't really think that these allegations are credible. I think that there are quite a few people who believe the governor was wronged. And you could hear him sort of echoing that and hinting that in his resignation slash apology, which I put in quotes.
Rebecca, I want to come to something that Chrissy said, though, here around this idea that if he was raised in captivity, if he has been, as you were pointing out, sort of gauging in these practices for such a long period of time, I've been worried across this long trajectory that at least in our media and public discussions of this, we tend to think that individual retribution, sort of removing the one bad actor or the few bad actors, is sufficient for changing these absolutely toxic and inequitable environments. And I'm wondering if there is a way for us to begin to push past that, certainly asking for individual accountability, but acknowledging and recognizing things like this do not go on without full institutional complicity.
Yes. And this is, I was just sort of sitting here nodding wildly as Chrissy was talking about, like, this, he comes out of Albany, right? This is not an Andrew Cuomo problem. It's not even a governor of New York problem, given that we also can point to Schneiderman, to Spitzer, right? These behaviors, and I'm talking not just about the sexualized harassment that Tish James's report just detailed. I'm talking about broader levels of toxicity, bullying, a view of power that is about dominance, lying, cover up, the idea that power comes from the top and that those with it can do anything to perform their dominance and thus build walls around their power, make those around them small and impotent while they become more powerful. This is an American norm. This approach, this posture toward authority is just absolutely woven in to an American apprehension of how power, including political power, work. And it's absolutely in Albany. It is in Washington. It is across the country. It is an old norm born within and made strong by the American form of brutal white patriarchy, right? So this is not just about Andrew Cuomo. The question is, and what is at this juncture, his resignation leads us to other questions about, can we revise our approach to how political power works, how you can build it, and how you can protect it? And in Cuomo's story, we see an example, right? Because it's built on people who were willing to challenge that power. There's not a lot of evidence that challenging Andrew Cuomo was going to work, right? He has won election, re-election, despite these, like, having been caught out in corruption and all kinds of things in the past. He keeps winning, right? There's not a lot of reward for this. Plus, he's a guy who is willing to punish. But you have people who are willing to come forward and speak up, despite the fact that all of history would say that's not going to work out well for them, right? Nobody's going to listen to them. They're going to listen to Andrew Cuomo, the guy with the power. Okay, but people did it. And so there are these questions. Can you build power from the bottom up? Can people who have historically been on the outside, including women, including people of color, people who have been marginalized by those at the center of brute white patriarchy, right? Can they build power, sometimes very often in coalition with each other, and build a strong enough base to actually challenge, correct, and bring down those who are abusing power in the center? That is an open and ongoing question in American politics. And Andrew Cuomo and his downfall is a really important data point. But it's certainly not the end of the story. It's just one tiny chapter in the middle of this far broader story.
Chrissy, as I'm listening to Rebecca talk about this possibility of building power, of gaining power in different spaces, can we just talk for a second about A.G. James?
you just called her A.G. James, but everyone in New York just calls her Tish. And I say that deliberately because I believe in honorifics, especially for women of color. But in Brooklyn, you know, Tish James's career has been one where she does the work and the promotions seem to come, unlike some of her male colleagues who were just doing things so they can get the promotion. So, of course, when the report came out, everyone asked, well, is she going to run for governor? She may or may not run for governor, but that report isn't for her to run for governor. She did not interview these women and interview hundreds of people in Albany just so she can run for governor. She took an oath to, you know, protect the citizens of New York State, and that's what she did. And it's a sad day for New York. I mean, first of all, the crimes that were committed in the report that are laid out are pretty egregious, and no one should have to go through those. And so, you know, I know that there's a lot of celebration, especially on the left, that Andrew Cuomo is leaving. But, you know, we elected a man to represent us, and he failed. And we have a long line of Democratic leaders in New York State who have failed us, and Republican leaders. I mean, there are many people in prison if you go through the list. So Tish James has an interesting future ahead. I think she's been slowly and steadily doing the work in Brooklyn, and it's led to her representing the citizens of New York citywide, and now it's statewide. We have to remember, Melissa, we've never had a black female governor in the history of the United States. So mm-hmm. if Tish James does decide to run for governor, even though she's won statewide as AG, as the first black woman to ever do so in the state of New York, she will still have an uphill battle because we don't have precedent. Many people still think that this report is a witch hunt, which Andrew Cuomo is tacitly saying that he agrees with. And there's a generational gap there seems to be in believing Andrew Cuomo and feeling as though he's wronged. And there's a generational gender gap where, you know, anecdotally, when you talk to older women, they don't really see what Andrew Cuomo has done as a crime or inappropriate in a way where he should lose his job. So it'll be interesting to see how the primary in New York plays out, how candidates, because it will be many, how they talk about not just policy and COVID, but also changing the culture in Albany and whether or not that will stick with the voters. We also know that women can be upholders of patriarchy just as well as men, especially white women historically. So we'll see if it's a Hochul versus James primary, how that also shakes out if those two emerge as the two leaders. So in many ways, the culture in Albany that Andrew Cuomo didn't create, he just expanded in many ways, was able to exist not just because of the men who like dominance and ruling by fear and power, but the women who also supported that and made that happen in such a seamless fashion for so long.
Chrissy Greer is an associate professor of political science at Fordham University. And Rebecca Traister is a writer at large for New York Magazine. And I'm about to get us a takeaway segment called Chrissy, Missy, and Becky Are Mad as Hell. And we're here to tell you why. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, you.
Melissa.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. The COVID-19 pandemic has been brutal on the hospitality industry. More than 110,000 restaurants and bars closed their doors in 2020, causing a loss of $240 billion. And now, restaurants are facing a staffing crisis as many workers resist returning to low wages, no benefits, and rude or abusive customers. I spoke with Dr. Sekou Sibi, the president and CEO of Restaurant Opportunities Centers United, and Dana Barker, a restaurant worker in the Bronx, about the needs of restaurant workers. Dr. Sebi tells us how his organization, Rock United, is helping.
Rock United is a nonprofit organization that's fighting to improve wages and working conditions for restaurant workers. And we do that through several ways. Workplace justice campaign, policy fight, but also workforce development training.
And Dana, let me also just come to you just so I can kind of establish where we are here. So tell me a little bit about the kind of restaurant that you work in the Bronx. No need to name it unless you have a great desire to do so.
I work at two, actually. I work as a bartender for both, but I'm actually a bar consultant. And I actually help one of the bars reestablish their bar and help them set up their bar display and also created their bar menu.
Okay, great. So I just wanted to kind of get, you know, kind of establish where we are for a second. So now let me go back to you, Dr. Sebi. Now, we're hearing reports of a shortage of workers at restaurants and food establishments. And, you know, one of the narratives that is emerging is this language of people just don't want to work. Is that what you're seeing?
No, I think it is a completely false narrative. The real issue that workers are facing is that simply the so-called shortage is driven by the wage. It is also driven by poor working condition. As of last month, the restaurant industry, according to the U.S. Department of Labor, added 253,000 workers jobs. Why? Because now we see wage increase and we see employers attempting to give better protection to workers. And these are two key elements that were preventing workers from coming to work.
Now, is this something that we saw before the pandemic, or is all of this, Dr. Sebi, being driven by the realities of the COVID shutdown?
No, it is. We've been fighting. I mean, Iraq has been created since 2001 after 9/11. We've been fighting for wage increase and improving working conditions. So these are factors that's pushing restaurant workers out of the industry. And the pandemic has only exacerbated a problem that existed before. Minimum wage is still at $7.25. And for tip workers, it's $2.13, which is too low to allow people to work.
Dr. Sebi, that's exactly where I was going, was to that tip minimum, just as a reminder to folks that for so many people working in the restaurant business, that as servers, as waiters, they're not even making federal minimum wage, right? They're making that tipped minimum. So again, just explain for us a bit more, and then I'm going to come to you, Dana, but tell us what that tipped minimum, you know, really turns out being for folks who are, what you know, kind of what they're taking home at the end of, say, a Tuesday night.
Yeah, it is a very low because, for example, now the lack of stability of the restaurant industry and the customers coming, no tourists are coming, means for servers or for tip earners, right, they don't know how much money they will be making day in and day out. In addition to the fact that the hourly rate is $2.13, if you add another layer, it is like restaurants are not employing enough runners. So servers are finding themselves doing cleaning job, which doesn't earn them tips. So it is a compounding problem that's preventing them from coming to work, because if they do, they don't make enough to earn a decent living wage.
Okay, so Dana, let me come to you on this and sort of, you know, that's the broad picture. Help us focus in on your lived experience. So the places where you're working, are you short-staffed?
Yes, and one of the restaurants actually is a new restaurant. It's it opened a year ago, and it has been hard for them to find stable staff members. It has been kind of hard.
Is that primarily about pay? Is it about working conditions? What are you hearing from the other folks who you work with about why it is so difficult right now to hire?
It's difficult to hire. Not to say that people don't want to work, but it's more qualified workers. I feel as though that there are a number of places that would rather hire someone that isn't as qualified as someone else so that the pay can be a little bit lower. So that also is something that has been a problem that I've also, you know, I've heard with amongst my colleagues in the industry.
So remind us, because, you know, on the one hand, anyone who has themselves worked as wait staff, or if you're paying attention when you're in a restaurant with a wait staff, then the question of qualifications is pretty clear, like the things that make, you know, great wait staff. But help us to remember for folks who maybe aren't paying attention when they're in those circumstances. When you say qualified, what do you mean? What are the things that really sort of, you know, set apart a great bartender or a great wait staff member?
Well, I want to say qualified, more so well-rounded, probably would be a better way to describe it. Someone that knows how to serve and to also multitask versus someone who may just know how to do one particular thing, but then also not having someone that is so qualified that they have to do all the positions. But it just kind of gives that establishment a balance of knowing when, and at least when someone else new comes on, that there's someone there that can also support and train and also do those things in accompaniment of, you know, keeping the restaurant in motion in an organized fashion.
So, Dr. Seeby, help us to think a little bit about the kinds of choices that are facing restaurant workers. So if it's been the pandemic, maybe the place where you were working was shut down and is beginning to reopen. Maybe you're talking about coming back for a sub-minimum, you know, tip minimum wage. Are workers simply moving on to different restaurants? Are they moving to completely different industries? Where are folks going?
I think that some are moving to completely different industries. Others are going to larger corporations that can provide better wages and working conditions. A large restaurant chain, for example, may have the financial backing to increase the wages, which is a good reason for them to pull workers from smaller restaurants. This is part of the reason why our fight has always been to level the playing field for everybody. The federal government need to be involved in, you know, increasing minimum wage at least to $15 and suppressing the tip of minimum wage. So leveling the playing field for everybody will not create a competitive disadvantage for smaller restaurants who cannot increase the wages right now simply because they don't have enough money. But larger restaurants are starting to understand this is why we see now more and more people being hired. But we need to put a legislation in place to increase that wage forever, from now moving forward.
So what would happen to small restaurants, to, you know, independently owned, maybe neighborhood restaurants who are already struggling in the context of the pandemic? What happens if you raise the labor cost by increasing minimum wage?
I think it is great if you can do that. I mean, this is what we're fighting for. But if only one restaurant does it and the other restaurant around them don't, then it puts them at a competitive disadvantage. This is part of the reason why the solution is a legislative solution. Larger restaurant with enough financial backing can afford that situation, but smaller restaurant may not be able to. This is why it is important. I really think it is important for us to have a policy in place, raise the wage act, increase minimum wage for everybody. So it becomes the law of the land. It is imposed to everybody. That will work.
Dana, do you like working in a restaurant? Is it something that you enjoy, or are you hoping as quickly as possible to be in some other kind of industry?
I love working in the restaurant industry, actually hospitality overall, you know, giving a person a sense of satisfaction and comfort when they come in. It's almost like, you know, having someone come to your home. It's about the hospitality and catering to others and being genuine.
I have to say, I also love that when I asked if you actually enjoy working in a restaurant, that you said yes. I feel like sometimes when we talk about how hard this work is, that we presume that simply because the work is hard, that no one wants to do it, that everybody hates being there, that everybody would rather be doing some easier job. But I also think it's important to acknowledge, no, actually, people like their jobs, but they'd like to have better working conditions to do their jobs in. Dana, I'm wondering if you can, like, if you're imagining maybe even in the context of owning your own business, what makes a place a great place to work? Like, when are you in a restaurant environment when you're like, all right, this is what feels good. This is why I do this work.
The one thing I can honestly say is working with a company or a business that has a mission statement that bases its foundation and its core goals and values on integrity, respect, morals, things of that nature. And also knowing that, you know, having suitable living wages, protection, paid leave, insurance, and that can happen in regards to illness, especially during the pandemic. That's something that as a business owner, I would, and I am working towards providing that for when I do gain employees and staff members.
Dana Barker, restaurant worker, small business owner, mixologist. Thank you for being here. And Dr. Sekou Sebi, President and CEO of Restaurant Opportunities Centers United. Thank you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
We asked you about your experiences working in this industry and whether or not the pandemic has made you rethink your career choices. Here's what you told us.
I do have concerns about getting sick at work. It's something that's in the back of my mind a lot, but it still hasn't made me rethink my career choice because I enjoy the work I do, but there is a concern about my health.
I've worked in a restaurant for most of the last 17 years, and when the pandemic hit, I stayed home and actually gave me an opportunity to reevaluate my career. I'm going back to school right now to try to become a doctor. The problem is I just started back up again last month at the restaurant, and now that the Delta variant has hit, it makes me a little bit nervous to keep going because I have two young kids who are obviously unvaccinated, and my wife is high risk because she's pregnant. So now that this Delta variant has hit, I don't really know what's going to happen. I don't feel particularly safe working in an environment where plenty of people are coming in with their masks off, who may or may not be vaccinated, but I don't know what opportunities or what options I really have.
Hi, this is Ella. I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. After COVID, I left a barista job for a local chain after over a decade. I was the manager the past 4 years, and we worked all through COVID. The managers were just expected to show up, and we were told, you guys are keeping us going until we get to the other side of this, so we'll all still have jobs. But none of us were given bonuses. We weren't given raises after the bulk of the pandemic was over. And mental health days weren't really something managers were taking. You could take a day off, but you were expected to answer phone calls and emails. And I quit. Now I work at a warehouse.
Name is at Afavon. I work in the hospitality field, and yes, working in a restaurant definitely makes me worry based on the fact that not all of the conclusions are definite, and also the fact that people put more into whatever the emotional mob mentality is until the act instead of the actual logic. Also being here, which was at one point first regarded as short term, but then became long term, it definitely makes me rethink being of service due to the fact that people are selfish, and it doesn't make me want to be a part of it. It doesn't want me to be a service to them. And I've already begun looking at going back into my original field of theater.
Hey, I'm Dan. I am a school superintendent in Southwest Arkansas, and we have a small school. We don't run a restaurant, but we do run a food service program, and we have had close to 100% turnover at our high school campus, and I believe this is due to COVID-related stresses for sure.
Hi, this is Tim from Orlando, Florida. I worked for a Darden restaurant on International Drive in Orlando when I was in college for 4.5 years. Back then, it was great because the area was busy and the tips were usually pretty good. I couldn't imagine being in that industry today, though. I'm lucky to be out of the hospitality industry and be able to work from home and from the office in the HCRM industry.
Now, what about you? Has COVID made you rethink your career in the restaurant industry? Tell us about your experience by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. We're living in a time of extreme weather. Drought and wildfires are raging in the western United States. Floods recently devastated communities in Europe and China. And punishing heat waves have claimed hundreds of lives in recent months. These weather changes were recently confirmed in a sobering new report on our planet's future from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC. The landmark study found that human behavior is changing the climate in unprecedented and sometimes irreversible ways. According to the UN, the report is, quote, a code red for humanity. But there's some hope. Scientists say climate catastrophe can be avoided if we act collectively and quickly. And we need to do this in both big ways. Yeah, I'm looking at you, corporations and the Biden administration. And also in small ways. So for those of us without the keys to industry or public policy, one way we can mitigate our own contribution to climate change is by supporting our local farmers market. Farmers markets have become staples in cities and towns all across the U.S. They're places where you can not only buy locally grown fruits and vegetables, but also connect with your wider community. The Cobblestone Farmers Market, just a few blocks from my home in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, has long been a staple of my weekend mornings. And during the pandemic, it became an open-air lifeline for food, for safely distanced neighborhood check-ins, and for a walkable weekly destination to soothe quarantine cabin fever. For more on the importance of farmers markets, we're joined now by Willa Shake, Deputy Director of the Farmers Market Coalition. Willa, it is so great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with the relationship between climate change and farmers markets that I talked a little bit about in the intro. What do farmers markets have to do with mitigating climate change?
Such a great question. So many research papers indicate that by facilitating farmer-to-consumer interactions, farmers markets shift both purchasing habits of consumers and the growing practices of farmers, which eventually leads to the adoption of more sustainable practices. 81% of direct marketing farmers incorporate cover crops, reduced tillage, on-site composting, and other health, soil health benefits and practices to their operations. Farmers selling at farmers markets minimize the amount of waste and pollution they create. Many use certified organic practices, reducing the amount of synthetic pesticides and chemicals that pollute our soil and water. A growing number are also adopting other low-impact practices, such as on-site composting, that help mitigate climate change and other environmental issues. So we know that farmers markets are actively contributing to the climate crisis every single day.
And, you know, it was so useful for me to learn really from my local farmers market, from Cobblestone, that relative to the question of climate change, that actually buying local was more impactful even than buying organic. It's not to say that organic doesn't matter. It absolutely does. But that as a consumer, I was actually maybe doing my very best work when I walked somewhere and bought something that had not traveled, you know, on an airplane to get to me.
Absolutely. We know that farmers markets play a critical role in developing local and regional food systems that foster free enterprise and ethically grounded economic behavior. Markets are a great way to support the economic viability of the producers who want to operate outside of the industrial food system. We know that they help grow rural economies. And I think that understanding the context of food democracy is really useful in understanding these influences, because food democracy is the idea that all people, all of us, can actively participate in shaping our food system rather than, I guess, remaining passive. That we have the power to determine agri-food policies and practices that support our natural resources like soil and water and wildlife. And many farmers have a deep desire to shift our food system in this way. So buying local is very, very important. You're providing economic opportunities for the grower and you're contributing to a resilient food system, definitely.
What do you say to the critique that farmers markets are just white people stuff, that black and brown people don't have any opportunities to make use of farmers markets as consumers, that they're too expensive, that they're outside of our communities?
I think that there are some farmers markets that don't feel inclusive when you first walk in. However, There are many farmers markets that provide an opportunity for all communities to build a relationship with their grower, to go in and ask questions, and over time help with influencing habit change. Farmers markets also provide accessibility and inclusivity because they also offer, many offer electronic benefits transfer technology that can be used by recipients of the USDA's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Programs. And this includes low-income women, infants, children, and seniors participating in the WIC and Seniors Farm at Market Nutrition Programs to get fresh and seasonal ingredients. There are many markets that cater to the cultures surrounding their communities. So I say that, yes, sometimes it feels like they might not be inclusive or accessible, but they're working really hard to incorporate everyone into the mission of being a positive, equity-focused space that's centered on equity.
Willa, our listeners have been calling and telling us just how important farmers markets are to them. Let's hear a few.
This is Carly Hill from Silver Lake, California. And I just wanted to say that farmers markets are a way to learn about your community through food. I go to the Hollywood Farmers Market weekly and love seeing seasonal ingredients and the culture of my city. The fact that I get to meet the people who grow our food brings me closer to my city and the beautiful state of California.
This is Elizabeth Lorenz. I'm calling from Menlo Park, California. And my daughter and I go to two local farmers markets and have gotten to know the growers and hear their stories. We love the feeling of receiving food or honey or peaches from those who watered and cared for and picked it. Last year, we got to experience growers who were literally in smoke dealing with the coastal fire near the Santa Cruz Mountains, trying to salvage their strawberries. And another time, we talked to the man who makes his own spicy olives and mixes them up for my daughter.
This is Liz Wilson from Doylestown, and I look forward to visiting the farmers market all winter long. Cooking clean, fresh, local, and in season is a joy, and supporting small farmers and local economy benefits us all. It's a win-win-win.
So, Willa, you just heard there from some of our listeners about sort of how they think about farmers markets in their lives. And I think part of what's interesting to me is they're not just talking about food, but also about community. How is it the farmers markets operate in that way?
Farmers markets to provide an opportunity for you to directly connect with your food source, to ask questions to your grower, to connect with your community, simply walking around and seeing what's available and sharing stories and sharing questions and asking each other just what's happening in your community. It serves as a place where it serves as a cultural hub for people to come together. For everyone to come together and share and celebrate what their communities have to offer.
I was struck also by hearing the caller talk about speaking directly with a farmer who was managing, in that sense, weather catastrophe, likely, you know, connected to climate crisis itself. And, you know, on the one hand, I'm thinking, okay, right, I actually would be less annoyed by paying more for strawberries if I'm actually talking with someone who's explaining to me how their strawberries are endangered by a fire, right, that I understand locally. But I'm also wondering about how these climate changes that we first began with, this extreme weather, how is it impacting farmers markets and the farmers who sell there?
At the beginning of the pandemic, we saw so many supply chain struggles. I think that farmers did an amazing job in adapting quickly to all the changes that were happening during COVID and also environmental changes that continued to occur by providing charitable food donations, creating distribution points, some even created online markets, and of course, like adapting public health requirements. I think that farmers markets and farmers continue to just show how resilient they are and will continue to be resilient.
And It feels to me like the word farmer in some ways is something we don't completely understand. On the one hand, farmers are the landowners, right? Who actually own the deed to the property that they are farming. But often farmers what we think of as farmers are the farm workers, right? Folks who are often themselves have nutritional challenges, right? We know that many farm workers do rely on those supplemental nutritional dollars from the federal government and other needs, which is wild to me, right? That the very people who are feeding us sometimes can't feed themselves. How are farmers markets engaged in sort of that broader question of farm labor and as we were talking about with equity and food democracy, right? How do farmers markets either help or in any way connect to those big questions?
Of course. So farmers markets fuel local economies. 53% of farmer market managers that responded to a 2020 USDA NASS market manager survey said that they were paid employees. So we know that many farmers markets are directly employing their market managers. And some are providing opportunities for incentive programs for them to directly purchase from the farm. And they're also, because they're practicing sustainable practices, I think that farmers care about the way that their food is grown. They care about making ethical choices around the way that the growers are taking care of, making sure that they're making a fair, livable wage, making sure that they have health benefits and can take care of their families and themselves. So I definitely think that farmers markets and farmers are contributing to creating a more equitable market for everyone to benefit from.
There is no doubt that I absolutely dislike taking my kid to the grocery store. I hate the ways that, kids' food is marketed down low at kid height. I hate those aisles at the very end that's got all the, $4 thing that you can buy as you're checking out. I'd rather never take her to a grocery store. But farmers markets, let's do it, right? On the weekend, let's go. So I'm wondering also about kids and about schools and the ways that farmers markets might be partnering with young people in everything from kind of future farmers of America to just parents who want to avoid the grocery store aisles.
I think that there's so many things that you can see at your local food markets besides food. Some offer opportunities for cooking demonstrations, live music for communities to connect with each other, composting, arts and craft. I think that these markets are so rooted in community. There's so many collaborations and innovations for problem solving and learning and for everyone in the family to come and join and see and partake in exactly what's going on. And so unlike going to the grocery store where you sometimes, at least for myself, I have to mentally prepare myself to do this. going to a market is fun. It's engaging. It's a great way to participate in experimental learning. It's a great way to get your kids involved in the shopping portion. It's a great way for your kids to talk to the producers. So everything is tangible. Everything is direct and feels more real in a lot of ways. To me, it feels like a community space.
Absolutely. And even though during the pandemic, Cobblestone did change the rules as they had to, as a necessity, we couldn't bring our dogs anymore. But it often was also a place where I got to know all the pets in the neighborhood.
Yes.
Willa Shake is the deputy director of the Farmers Market Coalition. Willa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay, y'all, that's the show. Can you believe we are already midweek? Woo! Time flies when you're having fun on the radio. And since the weekend is creeping up on us, I say go check out a local farmer's market. I definitely will be doing the same. Call us with your show ideas and suggestions. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.